I looked up Elisha in the PC Study Bible just to look at how many times that name occurs. And the only Elisha that we have, of course, is the one that we're talking about here, who was the servant of Elijah, and then took the mantle, as it were, of Elijah. His name occurs 59 times in the Bible. Three of those occurrences are in 1 Kings, toward the end, in chapter 19, a prophecy by Elijah about what Elisha will do. And then the rest of them are in 2 Kings. I found it interesting. I didn't realize this before, but as you go through here, there are no references to Elisha in the Chronicles at all, which I found kind of surprising, I guess. But I guess God covered it all in Kings. So anyway, and of course, there's one reference, of course, to Elisha in Luke, the 4th chapter, in verse 27, where he says, "And there were many lepers in Israel at the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian." Of course, now I've given the story away. Oh, well. But anyway, so let's just look at Elisha. Now, at the end of class last time, we talked about the fact that Elijah had been told to go get Elisha, who was in Elisha the son of Shaphat, and let me see, where was it? There it is. So, as it says right here, it says, Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel Meholah. And now, so I looked that up, and so the burg of Abel Meholah is right there. So it's essentially right on the Jordan River. This little note here, which I can't see any clearer on my computer, says birthplace of Elisha. So we realize that that's where he's from. And so he's pretty centrally located in the land of Israel. And he gets around, but that's where Elijah went to find him. What was Elisha doing at the time that Elijah went to get him? Pardon? No, that was Elijah was wishing he was dead. Then he was told to go find Elisha. So if we look at this right here, Elisha right here, and get into 2 Kings, pretty much the same thing that Saul was doing, a lot of people are doing this. So he's plowing. See, with 12 yoke of oxen before him, apparently he was amongst a team of people that were plowing this area here. So when it says that he departed thence, that's Elijah departed from where he was, found Elisha the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 oxen, yoke of oxen. He was, and he with the 12th. So Elisha was kind of in the back eating all their dust. You don't want to be the 12th one. You want to be the first one. Anyway, so Elijah went over there, and this is where they formally meet one another. I think that perhaps we could say that Elisha knew about Elijah before that time. Most of the people did.
Where is that?
What? Oh, I'm sorry. It's 1 Kings 19:16. No, 19:19. Yeah, that's where I got the little arrow pointing at right there. Yeah. 1 Kings 19:19. So that's where we're introduced to Elisha, and we see that he's plowing a field, like apparently a whole lot of people do. So who do we think of? Saul did that. And others, there were others, I think, that we might be able to think of that were plowing with oxen when we came upon them. Anyway, as we look at this, then we understand that Elijah came up here essentially to the middle of Israel to go fetch Elisha, and then as we discussed last week, what did they do? They went in verse 2 Kings 2 and 4. So they came to Jericho. So that's where they were. So they both went to Jericho. Elisha was warned at that time in verse 5 here that God was going to take Elijah. And then what happened after that? All right. They go down. What's Jericho near? Something of import. It's the Jordan River. Right. And as Mickey mentioned last week, the Jordan River was parted then the second time in history by what? Right. Okay. So Elijah, his mantle or coat or cloak or whatever mantle is, he hit the water with it and it parted and they passed over in mud up to their knees, right? Right. Just like was mentioned in the parting of the Red Sea and in the first parting of the Jordan River, it says they parted over on dry ground. Now, when was the last time that the bed of the river of the Jordan was dry? Like creation. You know? The thing is that the Jordan River has been running for who knows how long. Where they walked has never been dry. And yet when Elijah and Elisha walked over, it says it was on dry ground. So that's very interesting. So we see that God definitely performed this miracle on behalf of Elijah and Elisha so that they could go across the Jordan River. Yes, ma'am.
You watch these shows sometimes that try to explain Bible stuff, and I just keep watching them because they always try to explain it away by some crazy, unusual, natural phenomenon.
Right.
But they never talk about the fact that the ground was dry. That's never something that they can explain.
As a matter of fact, I went... Yes. Yeah, the wind blew, and yeah, I went to see a movie last night at the movie theater, and apparently there's a movie coming out soon called Moses, or something similar to that. And so there were all sorts of bloody scenes of people, swords and staves and you know machine guns and all that sort of stuff. And the thing is that they're showing the Israelites passing over the Jordan River, and the Egyptians in hot pursuit of them. And there's water all over the place. You know, puddles here and lakes there. And, pardon? What did I say? The Jordan? Yeah, they didn't do that. The Red Sea. And
it's a movie.
So, yeah, that's right. They crossed over the Mississippi. So, yeah. So, they're doing this thing, and they're showing all this water all over the place on the ground. And the chariots, some of them are getting kind of bogged down and stuff like this. This is before the water moves back. And, of course, the Israelites are trying to hoof it out of there before the water falls back down because the Egyptians are only like that far behind them.
Didn't the cloud block their view, too? Didn't the cloud descend?
Yeah, it's a little detail, Yeah, we'll just leave that out of the movie. Yeah, minor detail. Bruce.
Isn't this the third time that God showed
Third time that he parted a water for this purpose, right? So there was the Red Sea to begin with, and then the Jordan River when they passed over originally into the land, and now Elijah has caused the parting of the river by hitting the water with his coat mantle thing. Now, as we discussed last week, what requirement is there of Elisha in order to obtain Elijah's blessings or power or whatever it is? Yes.
He has to be able to see Elijah ascend into heaven.
Okay, so if Elisha is there and sees Elijah, the thing is that ever since Elijah picks him up out there in the field with the oxen, well, actually, that's at a later time, but after they get together, Elijah's trying to make him go away. It's like this is the third time he told him to go away. And Elisha says, well, I'm going to stay with you. And actually what he says is, you stay here, I'm going to go there. And Elisha says, no, I'm coming with you. I'm pretty sure this is the third time And then when they get to the other side of the Jordan River, you know, Elijah says to Elisha, you stay here and I'm going to go over. And he says, no, I'll stay with you. And fortunately he saw Elijah taken up in what? Chariots of Fire, right? Wasn't there a movie by that name a number of years ago? I don't think it had anything to do with this, but there was a movie about that. So, yeah. So as Elijah is being taken up into heaven, what does he lose? What falls from his grasp or whatever? His mantle. Okay. And Elisha picks up the mantle. And now he has received the power that Elijah had. And Elisha goes over and he does the same thing to the Jordan River. And he crosses over on dry ground.
Doesn't he get a double portion?
He does get a double portion. Yeah, it said that.
And is that where we get that phrase about taking up the mantle, taking over someone?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised, because this is, you know, these words have been around for such a long time.
Right.
So yeah, you take over somebody's job or something like that, or his cause or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I take on the mantle of whomever. Yeah. So this indeed could be where it comes from. We'll have to do an etymological study of that and find out. So we'll want a 12-page report on that next time. All right. There it is. The chariots of fire in verse 11. And then you're right. It talks in here about the fact that there was a double portion. Is it up above that? 9? Okay. All right, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. So he gets that. So in verse 13, the mantle fell from Elijah as he was taken up into heaven by God and the chariots of fire. So then Elijah does the same thing. Interestingly enough, the prophets that were there at Jericho, when they saw Elisha part the water with Elijah's mantle, they came to the conclusion that he had some sort of powers to part the water. And so they observed this and acted accordingly, of course. Now, they were very interested, however, in making sure that Elijah was definitely gone. I mean, they didn't want to leave him abandoned somewhere. They said, well, what if God plopped him down on top of a mountain somewhere and he needs help, is essentially what they're saying. So these 50 prophets argued, as it were, or made their case with Elisha for a while. It says in the American Standard, until he was ashamed. In verse 17, and when they urged him till he was ashamed, he said, send. And so they went about for 3 days looking to see if Elijah had been cast abroad in some field or on a mountain or, you know, in the middle of another river somewhere, and see if they could find him. Well, they couldn't find him because he'd been taken up to heaven with the chariots of God. And he says, there's a lot of this in verse 18. He says, didn't I say to you, go not? So I know what's going on here. So now the people of Jericho are having a problem with their water supply. What's that? It was poisonous. Yeah, there was something wrong with the water, and if you drank it, it says the land miscarrieth. In other words, the water, there's something wrong with the water. And it's interesting that the Jericho's been around for a long time. At least the site of Jericho has been around for a long time, and you'd think that the water would be okay, but apparently something happened, and now the water isn't any good. And they can't drink it. They can't use it apparently for irrigation, because it says the land miscarrieth in the American Standard Version in verse 19 of chapter 2. So he tells them to bring him a jar and put salt in it. And they do that. And he casts it upon the waters, and the waters are fine now. You can go to Jericho, and of course they've got flashing neon signs there that says water that Elisha fixed, you know. Kind of like you go to Egypt and they've got signs flashing, Jesus slept here. You know, they'll tell you about this if you take a tour of the, in the Jericho area. Well, here's the spring that Elisha fixed. Probably a number of springs around there, but anyway.
Just one.
Spring's a spring, right? So once you've seen one, you've seen them all, but this one's fixed. So, all right. Now, he was down here at Jericho, and then like, oh, I needed to show you something. Well, let's talk about this first. So, at an indeterminate period of time after this, it says in verse 23, and he went up from thence unto Bethel. Okay. Now, what happened on his journey to Bethel?
He was taunted.
Taunted by what?
Teenage
brats. That's right. It's interesting to note that if you read the various versions of the Bible in this area, some people will put them as very young children, and the others will say all the way up to teenagers. But here's a curious thing right here. It was in the Message, the Bible in Contemporary Language, or something. Let me see, where was it? Where do we go? There it is, verse 23, right? Verse 23, read that one. Another time, Elisha was on his way to Bethel, and some little kids came out from the town and taunted him, "What's up, old baldhead? Out of our way, skinhead." Elisha turned and took one look at them and cursed them in the name of God. Two bears came charged out of the underbrush and knocked them about, ripping them limb from limb, 42 children in all. Now, the reason that I wanted to show you this was to show the adultery that people do to God's word. These words aren't in the Bible. They've made them all up. They've taken the story and they've made up words that make it sound more interesting to them. There's nothing here that says, you know, that implies that they're saying out of our way, skinhead, anything like that. Not that they're trying to imply that skinhead is the term of skinhead that we would use today, but the fact of the matter is that these people are taking in what they refer to as the Message. They're just adulterating God's word. There is another one here. If I go down to one of the more standard perverted versions, let's see, was it New Century? No, there was one of them anyway that said that the sense of the verses indicated that they were taunting him to follow Elijah is what when they say go up thou bald head, what they were saying was you go up to heaven too. So, but he was going up to Bethel also, Jenny.
The one that you just showed said two. So whichever one you were just looking at, and go up from two.
Oh yeah, go up two. Yeah, go up two, you bald head. Go up two. So, yeah. And tore 42 of the boys to pieces. So, parts is parts. Yes.
It's not like five or six, you know, teenagers.
It's like a gang. Yeah.
It's like a troop.
Troop? Well, it was a Boy Scout troop. They were out on a camp out. Do what? That's a different. That's the Boy Scout version. That's right. Yeah. So he. So this happened. And we note that we should get the impression from verse 23 here that it's not a good idea to mock God's prophets. So I think that perhaps some of the people of that neighborhood learned that rather quickly there. Now, it says now that he went to Mount Carmel. So if we go back and look at the map, let me see. I don't know that making it maximum size does us any good. Well, it does a little bit of good. But so we were here at Jericho, and he was going up the hill, up the mountains, to Bethel, probably following this river course right here. And now, after he goes, he's going up to Bethel. Why would he go to Bethel from Jericho? It seemed to be a place where a lot of the religious people hung out. In other words, there were prophets at Jericho. And I don't remember whether Bethel was one of the cities of refuge or not. Anybody remember? But the thing is that I think in the cities of refuge, they had a tendency to locate a lot of the Levites in those areas. So there may have been more people that were spiritually minded at Bethel than there were at other places. Now, then it says that he went from Bethel to Mount Carmel. So that's quite a ways. Going along quite a ways. But Elijah and Elisha both seem to be prophets more of Israel than they are of Judah. Even though, you know, both sides kind of use them to a certain extent. So it says that after the incident with the bears and the kids and things like that, then he went up to Mount Carmel, and then it says he came back to Samaria. I always thought, well, why does it say he came back to Samaria? Because it doesn't say about him being there. But the thing is that going from Bethel to Mount Carmel, you go right through Samaria. So he would have gone through Samaria to go to Carmel. So it said that he came back to Samaria. Samaria, of course, was the capital of
Israel.
Followed closely by Jezreel, right? Apparently that must have been the summer home or something, like you say, for some of the kings, because Ahab and Jezebel lived there. But also we see that in this time that some of the other kings were from Jezreel also, or at least stayed there a lot. But I think sort of the capital was in Samaria, but Jezreel was the summer home. Elisha goes back to Carmel, or goes to Carmel. Now we've got the king's series starting up again. And so now we're talking about Jehoram, the son of Ahab. And Jehoram came on board over Israel in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat. And he reigned for 12 years. So, you know, I was trying to... Mickey likes this chart that we have in the book. We have this right here that shows that Ahab, right here, and Jehoshaphat reigned simultaneously in Judah and Israel for a while. And let me scroll this up a little bit. It's in your book on pages 103 and 104. So we can see here that Ahab reigned for 22 years, Jehoshaphat for 25 years, but Jehoshaphat doesn't start until Ahab's been around 4 years. And then he continues on for another 25 years. But we'll see here that in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, then Ahaziah, Ahab's son, takes over because Ahab did something like die. Ahab was, it says, slain in battle. You'll remember that he was killed in the battle. And as a matter of fact, he was killed in the battle when Jehoshaphat was with him, right? Yeah. So that battle went along where, I mean, they were fighting whomever. Who were they fighting? Ben-Hadad, so it must have been the Syrians. They were constantly fighting the Syrians in this particular time. So Ahab says, Jehoshaphat, come up here and help. And Jehoshaphat says, well, we're just like you. We're the same. You know, we're brothers. So he goes up there, and Ahab tells him to dress in his kingly garb, and Ahab's going to dress in the soldier's uniform, because apparently he actually wants to go out and get in the battle. He realizes that if he was in his kingly garb, that they would be shooting for him, because Ben-Hadad has already told his archers to aim for the king. And but when the archers are ready to shoot Jehoshaphat, what they realize that, oh, this is Jehoshaphat. So he must have had a big sign on his back or something that says, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, or something. Or they were looking at, you know, apparently very distinctive garb or something like that. And so they leave off from following after Jehoshaphat. And then what happens? It hits Ahab right between, it says, in the, between the plates of armor. Chris?
I thought Jehoshaphat, he
prayed or something, or asked for help from the prophets or something like that, and then they realize then, like, well, this can't be Ahab. This, or am I thinking of something completely different?
Maybe it's the next battle. Maybe the next battle where he's with the Edomites and King Ahaziah of Israel. There they go down and they talk to Elisha. But I think they had a discussion here, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's when all the priests of Baal said, yes, it's going to be fine.
Right.
But Jehoshaphat says, isn't there anybody, a prophet of God here?
Right.
And that's where he said, yeah, I'll go ahead and it's fine, but
right.
It's not.
And this is where we see the heavenly story, where the discussion went on in heaven about who's going to tempt Ahab, or who's going to get Ahab to get his just rewards, as it were. And so there were a number of discussions that apparently God was having with his messengers, and finally, a messenger said, well, I'm going to put a spirit of error in Ahab's prophets. And then Ahab, is this the one where we were talking about Micaiah? Is it Micaiah in this instance where, let's see if we can find that.
2 Kings 3 is not
Micaiah. It's not Micaiah, no. Oh, 1 Kings, what, 2?
22.
Oh, 22. Okay. All right. So,
verse 13.
Yeah. So this is Elisha or Elijah?
Elisha.
Okay. I got it. All right. So there's a lot of discussion with kings and prophets and things here. And it seems to be a sort of a universal thing with Ahab that he just doesn't like any of the prophets, because none of them seem to prophesy anything the way that he wants them to, except the prophets of Baal, who do his bidding anyway. So, all right. So we've got then Jehoram taking over for Ahab, and he did evil, but not exactly like his father. But so Ahab is now dead because the arrow got him by luck, and he died. And what did it say? It said that they washed the blood out of the chariot at the gate of Jezreel or something like that, and the dogs licked the blood and such. So it was part of the prophecy. And then Jezebel would get her comeuppance later on here. So we'll see about that. It's interesting to note that we don't name a lot of our daughters Jezebel. I haven't, no. all right, so now we have Jehoshaphat still reigning in Judah, but Jehoram, Ahab's son, is now taking over for Ahab because Ahab died. He was a bad king, but he did put away the pillar of Baal that his father had made, it says in verse 2. And it says, he still cleaved to the son, to the sins, rather, of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Now, who's Jeroboam, the son of Nebat? That's right. First king of divided Israel. First king in the northern kingdom. And it's a sort of a standard phrase that's used for a lot of the kings talking about cleaving to the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Because Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, is the one who set up a lot of the idolatrous worship practices of the northern kingdom. Now, when he did that, what did many of the people of the northern kingdom do?
They abdicated down to Judah.
Yeah, they defected, as it were. Yeah, and then I think that's one of the reasons why they started setting up these forts and things like that, to keep people from defecting.
Well,
yeah, that's right. It's like the Berlin Wall, right? All right. Now, and I think we've already discussed this because Mickey's mentioned several times about the king of Moab being a sheep master, and he was the one that gave tribute to King Ahab. Now, let's go back here to our map. And if we pull it down a little bit, we can see down here that down by the Dead Sea, we have the territory of Moab. Up here, Ammon and Gilead. And so what it is that because of the Dead Sea, it's kind of difficult for Israel or Judah to get to Moab. You got this big old sea right in front of you. And so you've got to go around to do anything. Now, in this discussion that we're having here, we see that they decide, the king of Moab decides that he's not going to give tribute to Israel anymore. If we look at the lands of Israel, we see that they actually come down here on this side of the Jordan River also. So they essentially border Moab, but the vast majority of people are over here on the other side of the Jordan River. So when the king of Moab decides that he's not going to give tribute to the king of Israel anymore, then the king of Israel gets a little upset at that. What king of Israel is this now? That wasn't the one that I was thinking of. Let me see. I think it's Ahaziah. Yeah. Right here, so he only... Yeah, that's, you can't really see it here, but on page 104 of your book, we're still in the reign of Jehoshaphat over on the left side, because Jehoram comes down here on page 105. And so...
but in verse 6,
well, it must be Jehoram then. But it could be Ahaziah. But it's Jehoram because it says it's Jehoram. Okay. I was just looking at this right in between where it says Ahaziah and Jehoram. It says Jehoshaphat and Ahaziah joined forces. Oh, that's about the navy. Okay. All right. Whatever fails. Mortally wounded. Okay. Sorry. So, yeah. Jehoram. All right. So, we got Ahab receiving tribute from the king of Moab. When Ahab dies, they decide not to do anything anymore, and apparently Ahaziah doesn't really care. But when Jehoram took over, and he reigns for what, 12 years, is it? 12 years. He doesn't like that, so he says, hey, Jehoshaphat, let's go beat up on Moab. And they also bring with them Edomites. So down here. So it says that they made a big circuit around to get to Moab. So if they're going to get rid of Abel Meholah here. If they're going to muster all their forces from both Israel and Judah and Edom, I'm thinking that 7 days journey or whatever that they took probably went around this way, around the southern part of the Dead Sea. Because here's Edom way down here at the bottom. And so they had to pick up the Edomites somewhere. I think they did that. And so what happened was is that they kind of ran out of provisions as they were getting ready to attack Moab. And so things were not going very well for them. And that's where they go and they talk to then Elisha. Yeah. So in verse 10, the king of Israel feels that God has delivered everybody up into the hands of the king of Moab because, you know, they're all bad people. And so Jehoshaphat, as he has said before, is there not a prophet of Jehovah? And they say, well, yeah, I guess Elisha's around somewhere. And they go, it says Elisha the son of Shaphat is here, who poured water on the hands of Elijah in verse 11. But I'm not sure that we're thinking that he's necessarily with the army. I think they went down to find him somewhere. The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. So it doesn't say where they went down to, but they went with him. Now, what was Elisha's impression of the king of Israel.
This is where he says, out of respect for the king of Judah, I'll notice that you're here, otherwise I don't even see you.
I don't even see you. That's right. That's right. Like they say on the TV program, you're dead to me. You know. So the in verse 12 there, it says that they went down to talk to Elisha, and Elisha says to the king of Israel, "What have I to do with you?" He says, "Get you to the prophets of your father, to the prophets of your mother." And the king of Israel sort of pleads with Elisha to be nice. And Elisha says that if it wasn't for the fact that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were here, I wouldn't even recognize your existence. what then does God tell them to do? And we discussed this last time also. Make trenches, right? So there's this big valley somewhere around there, and he says, make trenches. And so, what is the purpose of their making trenches?
To hold the water.
To hold the water, yeah. So they made trenches, and God caused the water to pour down from Moab or Edom. Or it says, by the way, verse 20, by the way of Edom, it says, and the country was filled with water. So they made trenches, and God then caused water to pour into these trenches for the purpose of them being able to water themselves and their livestock, so that they could continue on with the battle. Now, it turns out they really didn't have to continue on with the battle too terribly hard, because what did the Moabites think about these trenches? Well, they thought it was a bit of a flood, but they thought it was a flood of what?
Blood.
Oh, blood. Blood. Gotcha.
They thought the battle was
over. So, yes, they thought the battle was all over, that the Israelites had done what? But they just turned on one another, and there was so much blood around that, you know, now the trenches were full of blood. Now, of course, in our scientific explanation, we realize that the sun is at an angle shining obliquely across the water during sunset, and so they think it's blood, and we realize that the Moabites are really stupid. But be that as it may, the Moabites then say, well, let's go down and do what? Loot the place, right? Because for some reason, all of the soldiers of this era, from the beginning of time up until, you know, like the 20th century, when they kill somebody, they loot the cities and the people.
Not
and
the,
the, yeah, up until the, yeah, right. So the apparently that the thing is that's sort of part of their pay, as it were. You know, if you want to get paid for being a soldier, you got to loot the houses of the vanquished and do what? Yeah, that's right. So anyway, so they're going to go down and they're going to loot the dead people that are down there. Where is it? In verse 23, it says, "This is blood." Yeah. The kings are surely destroyed. They smite each man his own fellow. So, but therefore they came down to the camp of Israel expecting just to find all sorts of booty there for them to take. And all they found out were Israelites that rose up and smote the Moabites. So it didn't work very well on their behalf. I guess we should, we would think about the, the battle that we talked about? I think it was last week or last time, about the when the four lepers found all of the Syrians, was it the Syrians gone? And so they were definitely all gone, but in this instance they weren't gone. They were waiting there with their swords. So they smote the Moabites. They went forward into the land, smiting the Moabites as they went. So they're having great, great victory here. Now, here's one thing. Apparently, it was fairly popular for them to do at that time, And I think one of the reasons that that land over there is in the physical condition that it is right now, is that they go through and not only did they utterly destroy the cities, but what did they do in this instance? Yeah, untillable. They took rocks from wherever they found rocks, and they put them in the fields and the cities and things like that, so that before anybody could do anything to make this place habitable again, they'd have to pick up all the rocks. Now, the thing is that it's been relatively common throughout history that people, when they go to conquer other people, will make sure that their land is no longer habitable. In a lot of instances, what they'll do is they'll pour salt in the soil and such a like as that. And, of course, if you're intending then to then occupy that land, that's not too good for you. But interestingly enough also, and I don't know whether this really has anything to do with it, but when you're over in the Middle East now, you don't see hardly anything built out of wood as far as structures go. It's all built out of concrete. That's because the cedars of Lebanon no longer exist. They denuded the entire land. Now, that's not this battle, but I mean, you see what they're doing here is they're cutting down the wood that they would use to build with. They're making it so that the people cannot inhabit this area again. Jenny?
It's notable, though, to point out that God told them to
yes.
in this situation.
That's right.
So I don't know that he necessarily always told them to.
No.
But in this one,
right.
he said to cut down all the trees and stop up all the springs and ruin every good piece of land with stone.
Right. So they were... 19?
19 is where the Lord said to do it.
Yeah. And so yeah, they were taking the land of Moab. Or well, what they were doing was they were teaching the Moabites a lesson is what they were doing, because, you know, you're supposed to be giving tribute to us and now you've quit doing that. And maybe they figured, well, if you're gonna do that, then we'll make it so you can't raise those sheep anymore. You know, because that's what the tribute was the wool of sheep and goats. And so now they wouldn't have it anymore. All right. smote the Moabites, yeah. It said it says here that he tried to break through to the king of Edom. I'm not sure what he means by that, because the Edomites were fighting with the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah against the Moabites. So it may be that he was simply trying to break through because he thought the king of Edom and his army was weaker than the other armies, and what he was trying to do. But they couldn't do that. Either that, or they were trying to get through to Edom because Edom is sort of out in the wilderness down here. And if we could escape from Israel, then, you know, we're down south and maybe they wouldn't pursue after us. Perhaps that's what it's talking about. All right. So, my understanding is that when it says, then he took his eldest son, that's the king of Moab, who should have reigned in his stead. He offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. So I don't understand this now. There was great wrath against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. I don't know whether there was great wrath against Israel because the people of that area realized that the king sacrificed his son, or what? But apparently the battle sort of ended. The Moabites were well done for. And Israel went home. So that might bear some looking at as to what exactly that means. And it may be that simply the people that were there in Moab, as you would think they would, really didn't like Israel much after this. Maybe they said, look, Israel forced the king to sacrifice his son on the wall. I don't know. So, next time, we'll get into chapter 4 about the woman whose children are going to be sold into bondage. And we'll discuss about that. All right. Thank you for your assistance.